I think we're going to go ahead and get started.
There's a sign-in sheet going around, so if everyone will just sign in if you already have, that's fine. And also, if you're interested in hosting, I've listed the dates on the top, so you can just write yes and the date you're interested in, and then I'll contact you later if we have more than one person. And I hope everyone enjoys it. Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, thank you so much to Annie for hosting us. Thank you to everyone who came out, who was here last time, or for the...
Rebecca,
yes.
Can't
oh, okay. So, you think I should sit over there? Yeah, that would work better. Yes, no. All right, Nada, sorry to make you move.
That's all right.
Okay, is this better?
Yeah.
Okay, great. I'm going to put down the tea, down the pen. All right, let's do this again. Thank you, everyone who came last time. It's great to see people who I've already met. Great to see new people. This is our series on models of Jewish leadership. Today, we're going to do something that's a little bit unfair, which is I'm going to try to talk about three people in the space of about 50 minutes. We're going to see how this works, because it is simply not fair to choose only one character to talk about. When we talk about who became the leader of the tribes of Israel, Jacob had 12 sons, and at the end of his life, he's going to pick, there are some spreadsheets over there, he's going to pick one person to be the leader of his family that would eventually grow into being the Jewish people. And we're going to spend a little bit of time trying to figure out who's that going to be. But before that, as I said last time, I also hope that over the course of the year, we'll study in some different ways of learning Torah. We'll introduce a new methodology each time we learn together. So what we're doing today is taking a very, very close look at how the Torah depicts specific personalities. We're not looking at a story. We're looking at people. And we're doing something that the commentators did in previous years, but it's something that's a little bit new, a little bit of a more modern take on the story, by saying, I'm not going to assume anything. I'm not going to come to the story knowing how it ends. I'm going to start and just look at the people who I am learning about, and I'm going to try to figure out what I can see just from what the text tells me. And I have here a quote from an article written by Howard Deacher on how Nechama Leibowitz specifically approached the study of biblical characters. Nechama Leibowitz is a major teacher of Tanakh of the past century and has greatly influenced the way almost everyone learns Tanakh today. And what he explains is that in considering the struggles and hardships that these biblical persons faced, we ourselves become directly involved in interpreting the issues that they dealt with. We cannot be apathetic observers from the sidelines. We must become active readers of the biblical text, engaged in an encounter with those same problems, challenges, and frustrations that they experienced. In the process of studying the biblical personalities, the reader is invited to explore the psychological motives that led them to certain actions. Only by investigating and grasping these motives can one plumb the story's depth of meaning for the contemporary reader. So what I'm going to ask everyone to do right now is to forget everything you know, is to try and pretend that you have not heard the story of Yosef and his brothers 1,000 times before. We're going to attempt to look at it with a blank slate and to figure out who in these stories impresses us, who in these stories comes out as a candidate to be the future leader of the Jewish people. And actually, this is appropriate. This coming week, we're going to read Parshat Vayeshev. We're going to read the beginning of the story of Yosef and his brothers. And in the first parak, the first chapter of this story, we meet three characters. We meet Reuven, we meet Yehuda, and we meet Yosef. Now, there is obviously a tension in the family of Yaakov, because normally the leader of a family is the oldest son. Now, Yaakov considers himself to have two oldest sons. Why is that? Yaakov had two wives, right?
Four wives.
Who were the two important ones? Rachel and Leah. Leah's oldest son was?
Reuven.
Reuven is the first son who Yaakov ever had. He's definitely the oldest of all of the 12 sons. But who was Yaakov's favorite wife? Rachel. And for years and years, Yaakov and Rachel waited to have a son. And when Yaakov finally had his son Yosef, it's clear that Yaakov felt a particular connection to Yosef. And even though he might not have been his oldest son of all of his children, he certainly seems to belong in the category of a potential oldest. We're going to have to figure out how does Yehuda get into here. Yehuda is Jacob's fourth son. He is the fourth son of Leah. We're going to see how he sort of inserts himself into the candidacy. We're going to start with the first psukim of Parshat Vayeshev, which introduce us to the tension that we're going to be following. It says, Vayeshev Yaakov be'aretz Megurei Aviv be'aretz Canaan. Yaakov lived in the land of his father's land of Canaan. Ela toldot Yaakov, Yosef ben Shva Asrei Shana. These are the generations of Yaakov. Yosef was 17 years old. Now,
should have stuck with the word
then. Now, here's a problem. The word toldot normally introduces a whole family. Ela toldot Noah. These are the generations of Noah. Immediately follows, Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yafet. But here, we hear, these are the sons of Yaakov, Yosef. Yosef is introduced as the most important son of Yaakov. Now, I have to tell you, just as a modern reader of Tanakh, that toldot does not always mean children of. There are situations in which it means this is the story of. For example, Ela toldot shamayim va'aretz. These are the stories of the sky and the earth, when God created the sky and the earth. So there is a read that this just means this is a major story in the life of Yaakov, but it's clear that Yosef is being highlighted here. Yosef is 17 years old. Haya ro'et achav batzon, v'hunar et b'nei bilha v'et b'nei zilpa, nishay aviv, v'yaveh Yosef et dibatam ra'a el avihem. Yosef is 17 years old. He is a shepherd and is a young lad with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, who are the sons of the handmaidens, the concubines of Yaakov. He's not hanging out with Leah's children. V'Yisrael ahav et Yosef mikol banav, ki ben zkunim hulo, vaselo ketonat hasim. Yaakov loved Yosef. There is no ambiguity. The Torah tells us straight out, Yosef was his favorite. He was his ben zkunim, which translates roughly to a son of his old age. It has a lot of commentators explain different ways that this phrase explains to us why it is that Yaakov loved Yosef, and he made him a special coat. We often refer to this as the coat of many colors. In other places, ketonet pasim refers to a coat of royalty. The only other person who we're told who wears a ketonet pasim is Tamar, the son of David HaMelech, so it seems to be some sort of princely coat. It's also not a working outfit. It's not something that you wear if your job is day in, day out to be a shepherd. It's something special. It's something unique. Yeah, Dori?
It doesn't say that Yaakov loved Yosef. It says Yisrael loved Yosef.
It's true.
That's a name change of the new thing.
It's true. I purposely did not call attention to that because there is a different shear here, which I'm not giving, but I would love to give separately, which is, when is the name Yisrael used and when is the name Yaakov used? There is a hypothesis that the name Yisrael is used in more national contexts and the name Yaakov is used in a more familial context. It doesn't work in every single case, and that's why I'm not suggesting that as the only way to read it. I'm going to ask that we try to see them as synonymous for the context of this year, but it's definitely something to notice. To be honest, I have the Tanakh here that I learned these stories from the first time, and I underlined in different colors each time it says Yaakov and each time it says Yisrael. I tried to do this for myself to figure out, oh, can I figure it out? Every time it's purple, it's Yisrael, and the blues are Yaakov. I wanted to come up with a theory. I didn't get one that works completely, and that's why we're not going to spend time talking about that. But it's true. As a close reader of the text, you do need to notice that. Yes?
It's strange that and he said the toldot, all of a sudden it brings some kind of information via Yosef dibatam ra'a el avihem. He's already a troublemaker. He's malshin.
Yes.
So is that a typical person
No.
that you want to be a leader?
So that's the problem. There's a major tension here because the person who's going to choose the leader of his sons is Yaakov. Yaakov seems to be pretty focused on a character who we're not getting the best impression of, right? There are, in fact, the commentators try to make Yosef come out a little bit better by saying, well, the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah were doing all sorts of sins, and Yosef needed to report on that to his father, who was doing a good thing. But from the text, it does seem like there's nothing to recommend Yosef. We have nothing to tell us great things about Yosef. And
why are we saying that as He brought these evil reports. What if you just
have a tail?
But he just has an awareness, and like I think that if I don't know, I just don't necessarily see that as bad thing yet. I'm not ready to label it.
So, and you're in great company. You're in great company with Rashi. Rashi thought, this can't be a bad thing. Yosef is known as Yosef HaTzadik, Yosef the Righteous. So, it must have been a fine thing. What we're pointing out, I'm sorry, what's your name?
Shula.
Shula's pointing out that, on the surface of it, we expect to be told great things about Yosef. Yaakov loved Yosef because he learned Torah all the time. He was nice to all the people around him. He was a great guy. Instead, we hear what seem to be the juvenile stories of Yosef getting into fights with his brothers. And we see in the last pasuk here, Vayiru achav ki oto ahav avihem mikol achav, Vayisnu oto v'lo yachlu debro l'shalom. The brothers saw that Yosef was loved by Yaakov, and they hated him. Now, of course, they hated him out of jealousy. This is fair. It doesn't mean Yosef did anything wrong. But we already see that Yosef is going to have a lot to overcome if he's going to become the leader of this group of brothers. And we see later in the chapter, Yosef has dreams of leadership. Yosef talks about having dreams where his brothers bow down to him, where stars bow down to him, his father is bowing down to him. Yosef believes what his father is implying. Yosef believes that he is going to be it. He is primed to take control of this family unit. Yes?
Will I still be offended by saying one of the things about the character of Yosef is that we see him grow, and we don't always see characters grow as we hear the stories. They come to us fully developed, and we don't have the opportunity to see how they mature as we do in the case of Yosef.
Right. So we may, at the end, if we have time, we're going to come back to what Yosef's life was like after these stories. But right now I want to move to the opportunity for two other characters to take control of their family. We know that the brothers hated Yosef, and Yaakov sends Yosef on a mission to go check on his brothers as they're shepherding somewhere far away. And so in the next source, we see Yosef is sent, and his brothers see him from far away, and they hatch a plot. They say, oh, the dreamer is coming. Let's kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Okay? They just want to get rid of this guy. They think, our family is doing fine. We don't need him. We don't need this little kid, right? He's the youngest. He's the second to youngest. We are not going to figure out what was Binyamin, Yosef's younger brother, doing at this time. We're going to assume he was not taking part in this plot against Yosef. So they make this plan. And now Reuven comes into the picture. If you look at Pasuk Chaf Aleph, or 21 in the translation, we see something very interesting. We see Vayishma Reuven, Vayatzilehu Miadam. Reuven heard, and he saved Yosef from their hands. Vayomer, Lo Nakenu Nafesh. He said to them, let's not kill a soul. Let's not kill a person here. Vayomer Aleim Reuven, Al Tishbehu Dam, Hashluchu Oto Habor Hazeh, Asher Bamidbar, Vyad Al Tishluchu Bo. And Reuven says to them, we don't need to spill any blood. Let's just throw him into one of the pits that are around us. You don't need to actually kill him with your hand, right? You don't need to take any active involvement in actually killing him. And then the text tells us, Leman Hatzilo Tomi Adam Lahashiva Aviv. And Reuven was doing this to save Yosef's life. And then we see what does happen. Vayhi kasher by Yosef Achav, Vayashitu at Yosef at Kutanto, at Ktonat Hapasim Asher Alav. Yosef comes, they strip him of this offensive coat, this coat that separates him from them. And they do what Reuven suggested. They throw him into a pit. Now, in general, what's our impression of Reuven here?
He's a leader.
He's a leader, okay? He's taking charge. We generally have a positive impression of him, right? Yeah? Everything's good.
Oh, yes. It's a little bit of a wimp out, but
it's a little bit of a wimp out. How do you mean?
You know, he's not confronting them directly and saying this is wrong. We're not supposed. We shouldn't do this. He is trying to do this by a subterfuge.
Okay, so you're picking up on the fact that his plan is going around what they're planning to do, right? His plan is, okay, we'll just put him in a pit. He's not saying, let's not kill him.
Right.
He's
letting them think he's agreeing to kill him, just we shouldn't be the ones to do it, put him in the pit and let him die there.
So you're right, based on what actually happens. But I want everyone to look. There's something very curious that happens in Pasuk Chaf Aleph, Pasuk Chaf Bet, or 21:22. There's something that happens in Tanakh that's called the occurrence of Vayomer Vayomer. And he said, and he said. You'll notice, in Pasuk Chaf Aleph, Reuven says, let's not kill him. And then Reuven says something again. Reuven starts to talk. Why does it say that Reuven spoke twice? When we see Vayomer Vayomer, we always need to ask, what was supposed to happen in the middle? And I'll tell you what was supposed to happen in the middle. Reuven tried to stop them. Reuven did try to say, let's not kill him. And everyone stared at him blankly. Everyone just said, no, that's not our plan. That's not what we're doing. And Reuven had to come up with a backup option. Reuven said, that's not what I meant. I meant, let's not actively kill him. Let's just put him in a pit. I would claim that Reuven tried not to kill Yosef. Reuven made an attempt in the first words, lo napeni nafesh. Sounds like he really doesn't want Yosef to be killed, but the brothers are not convinced by that. Does that work with everyone?
Well, how do we justify that when they say that the pit was empty and there was no water in it? So it's not like he left them with provisions.
Also,
it also seems like this is a pattern within the family. These boys are violent boys. From the story of Shen, nobody reprimanded them really and said, murdering a bunch of people is really not the way to handle your issues. So you have a very violent pack of boys here who don't think twice about killing.
Right. It seems like Reuven has done something impressive. They wanted to kill Yosef right now, and he managed to stop them. And we need to give Reuven a lot of credit for that. There's just one last thing that we need to note about the way the brothers react to Reuven. How do the brothers respond to Reuven's request?
They do what he says. He appears separate. That whole Vayishma thing means that there was all this talking going on and he was somehow separate and then he heard it. In other words, he...
Perfect. That's exactly right. Reuven seems to be separate. He comes in and makes the suggestion, and we're left in suspense. You realize what happens? In Pasuk Chaf Bet, Reuven makes a suggestion, and then we hear, Vayihi kasher b'Yosef el achav. Yosef comes. We don't know what they're going to do. Vayafshitu et Yosef et kutanto. They take off his shirt. And we're in suspense. We don't know if they've accepted Reuven's suggestion. Right? Yes, we know because we know they don't kill Yosef. But if we're reading this for the first time, we have no idea until finally the Pasuk tells us, oh, and they threw him into a pit. They didn't actually kill him. But it's important to note that the Torah doesn't tell us that the brothers listened. And that's extremely important because if you turn the page, we see the next brother who takes charge. Yosef is sitting in the pit and the brothers are eating lunch. The brothers are eating lunch, they see a caravan coming, and Yehuda has a brilliant idea. Yehuda says, why are we leaving our brother in the pit to die? Let's make a bit of money. And he says in Pasuk Chaf Zayin, L'chuvenim kareni l'yishma'elim, let's go sell him to the Yishma'elim. V'yadenu al tihibo, ki achinu b'sarinu hu. V'yishma'u achav, we don't need to kill him. And his brothers listen to him. The text tells us immediately that the brothers respond to what Yehuda says. Now, is Yehuda's idea a good one? Do we get a positive impression from what Yehuda's idea is? No. It sounds like he wants to make a buck off of his brother, right? He's trying to sell him to be a slave. He's not trying to save his life. This is not a great idea. But from a leadership perspective, Yehuda has the ear of his brothers. Yehuda knows exactly what they're going to respond to. Yehuda knows what they're interested in. And they listen, the Torah tells us that he is a part of this group, that he is sitting with his brothers and eating lunch. And they say, okay, great idea. And Yosef gets sold to Mizraim.
Why is money such an issue for these people? They're supposed to be really rich.
That's interesting. There's actually a major debate. I believe it's between the Ibn Ezra and Ramban as to whether the Avot had money, as to whether the Avot were rich. It's specifically about Yitzchak, that that they have a debate if Yitzchak had a lot of money or not. It's true that we have an assumption that Yaakov had a lot of money, especially from this week's parsha when Yaakov meets Esav and he has lots of cattle. I'm not sure if it's that they're poor. The way Yehuda presents it is Ma betza ki naharoget afenu. What are we going to get from killing our brother? Right? Once we're doing this, it's not that they needed the money, so they're selling him. If they needed the money, they would have sold him the first time around. I think it's more him saying, let's get something positive going on here. Let's not just kill him. Let's make something that when we come home, we'll feel great about what we did. Not just that we killed our brother, but we came home even better for it. I think you're right. We need to realize that the money isn't tempting them. Right? That makes it even worse. If they really needed the money, so I mean it's awful, but we would understand what's going on. Here there is no reason for them to sell their brother, aside from the fact that they feel like it. It really is not an impressive thing, right? It's really pretty awful. So we've now met three characters. We've met Yosef, who's primed for leadership, except his brothers hate him. We've met Reuven, who should be the leader of his family, except he doesn't seem to be completely integrated with the family unit. And we met Yehuda, who has nothing going for him, except that his brothers seem to listen to him. Now we're going to start and look at what happened to Reuven, because I will tell you, Reuven does not become the leader of this family. I can tell you that. I'm letting you know from the beginning. We're going to now look at what happened to Reuven. We're actually going to rewind a bit to look at an often overlooked pasuk in Parsha Vayishlach, which tells a very strange story about Reuven. The pasuk says, "Vayhi bishkon Yisrael ba'aretz ha'hi, vayach Reuven vayishkav et bilha pilegash aviv, vayishma Yisrael v'yu b'nei Yaakov shnemasar." While Yisrael, or Yaakov and his family, were living in a particular place, Reuven went. The pasuk tells us he slept with his father's concubine. Now, this is completely shocking. Most people don't either know the story or don't relate to the story. The first reason is because basically every commentator says it didn't happen. Basically every single commentator says that's not the story. If you look at Rashi explains that he did not actually sleep with his father's concubine. What he did was, I'm not going to read Rashi inside, he moved his father's bed from Bilhah's tent to Leah's tent. This is in the immediate aftermath of Rachel's death. Now, we all know that Yaakov loved Rachel the best, and even though he had four wives, he had a special bed that was always in Rachel's tent, that he could always go and spend the night with Rachel. And when Rachel died, that special bed was moved into Bilhah's tent. And Reuven reacted in an incredibly negative way. He was zealous for his mother's honor and said, "Look, I know that my father loved Rachel the most, because she was my mother's sister. They were on sort of the same level. But Rachel's handmaiden, the servant who became my father's wife only because Rachel asked, she's going to be the competitor to my mother? No, I can't let this be. My father has to spend more time with my mother, with Leah. She deserves it." So he moved Yaakov's bed into Leah's tent. Now, we could spend a long time talking about this story. What does that represent? Is that actually what seems like is happening in the story?
Doesn't say.
But yes, it does not say that. I will tell you there are a number of reasons why it's tempting to say that this story didn't happen. I'll suggest the first one is that when the end of the pasuk says "Vayihu bnei Yaakov shnemasar," Yaakov had 12 sons. All the commentators take this to say there were 12 sons. What Reuven did was not bad enough to kick him out of the family. Okay? Now we know that this family kicks sons out pretty often. Avram had 2 sons, Yishmael was gone. Yitzchak had 2 sons, Esav was out, right? So you can expect that when a son does something wrong, now this is not how we live now, we don't kick out children for things that they do wrong, but the Torah is telling us, no, with Yaakov, all 12 sons are in. All 12 sons are in, and no matter what Reuven did, it couldn't have been that bad. So I really don't want to get caught up in this, even though I know it's unfair to make the suggestion that seems to go completely against the text and say I don't want to talk about it, but I'm going to have to beg you to bear with me. Because what this does first is show us that there's some problem with Reuven. No matter what he did, when we get to the story of Yosef, we potentially understand why Yaakov is not putting all of his hopes on his son Reuven, right? Whatever it is that Reuven did, it didn't disqualify him from being a son, but Yaakov doesn't seem to put a lot of stock in him. Is that fair?
Why does this story bother us more than King David sleeping with a married woman and having her husband killed?
It doesn't. In fact, they're brought up in the same context in the Gemara. The Gemara discusses both of them, and in the same chapter tries to explain away both of them. And it's a very problematic issue, and maybe we may actually later in the year study King David. That would actually be really interesting if we spent the time just talking about him and his personality and how he could possibly sleep with another man's wife, have him killed. It's very troubling. But the Talmud takes the opinion that neither of these cases are as bad as they seem, because the Talmud has the opinion that these are still people who we need to revere, who the Torah includes as positive characters, and we need to trust that if they're being seen as positive characters, maybe they did something wrong. They certainly did something wrong, but it can't be as bad as we assume. But this does not give a great perspective on Reuven. And we're going to see the story sort of continues, because after Yosef is sold, we see something very sad. Reuven comes back, and Yosef's not in the pit anymore. Reuven comes back to check on his brother, to throw down the rope ladder and say, "Don't worry, we're going home to dad now." And Yosef is not there. And what does Reuven do? He rips his clothes in sadness. This is the best way the Torah has of telling us that someone is really, really sad. When they're sad, when people are ripping their clothes, you know it's bad. You know that they're going to be just, you know.
First off, where was he?
That is a great question.
That was my question. Was he busy with the bed when they were...
Okay, so he wasn't busy with the bed at the exact same time, but yes, where was Reuven? Wasn't Reuven with the family? So look, very quickly, look at Rashi. Rashi gives two answers. One answer is that each day one of the brothers would go home from work to spend some time with their father, and it was Reuven's day. The second answer that Rashi gives is that Reuven didn't have lunch with his brothers because he was fasting to try to atone for the sin of switching up his father's bed. Okay? Now, is that literally what Reuven was doing? Maybe. But what is Rashi trying to tell us? Rashi's trying to tell us that Reuven is not a part of this brotherly unit. Reuven was not eating lunch with his brothers because something in his past has prevented him from being the leader of this family.
Yes. I think it's important to point out that the brothers did not actually sell Joseph.
Right.
The Midianites found him and sold him to the Ishmaelites. So they had no part actually in the transaction. Wow.
So that's a debate between Rashi and the Rashbam. The problem is that Rashbam's great. I love the Rashbam as well. The problem is that the text is extremely ambiguous, and not only is the text here ambiguous, it's ambiguous as well in the next parak where we hear of Yosef being brought down to Egypt.
But if we take the text literally, it's the Midianites who take him out of the pit to sell him to the Ishmaelites.
Yes. And the brothers don't get any money.
And the brothers don't get any money, right.
Right.
So otherwise, the brothers would have known that he wasn't, like, the brothers had no idea he wasn't.
So the reason that most people are taught growing up that the brothers sold Yosef is because we have an expectation that the text is consistent with its pronouns. Okay? The reason is, okay, if we do go back and we look at Pasuk Chafchet, we see, okay, there are Midianim who are walking by, they're merchants, Vayim Shichu Vaya'alu et Yosef min Habor. And they pulled Yosef out of the pit. Now, yes, from a technical grammatical perspective, we do assume that that's referring to the Midianim. However, there are places in the Torah when words refer back not to the most recent person talked about, but sometimes to the person two pronouns ago. So there are reads of the text, which is a completely fair read, that the person pulling and raising is the people who were speaking before. Now, I understand that that's not the. I don't want to say which one's pshat, because pshat, in a grammatical sense, it's true. It does not sound like it is the brothers who are pulling Yosef out of the pit. However, There are reasons based on the later sources. There are plenty of reasons to assume that the brothers were the ones who sold Yosef. There are also plenty of reasons to assume that the brothers did not sell Yosef. Now, there's just one more thing I want to say, and with that, I'm going to ask that we move on because there's so much more to learn.
If you look at the map, which I don't know if the person that changed it, when they lifted up their eyes and looked and saw the caravan, they couldn't have been near the pit based on the topography of Israel. They had to be situated far away from the pit in order to physically see that caravan coming through. So there was really physically no way for them to have been part of this transaction based on where they were having lunch.
That's really interesting. I think that what we need to take away from this is that if the Torah wanted us to think that what happened was a tragic accident, that the brothers threw Yosef in a pit and he was kidnapped, the Torah could have said that. But the Torah does not want us to think that. The Torah blames the brothers for what happened to Yosef. Whether they did it or whether they just planned to do it, that's what the Torah wants us to think. So it's true, it may not have been their hands who pulled him out, but they get blamed for it. We don't normally blame people for having an evil plot. Here we do. Here it is very clear that the Torah wants us to blame the brothers for what happened to Yosef, even if they didn't actually do it. Yes?
But the fact that they emphasized that the Midianites were merchant men is implying that they would, you know, they would want to do a transaction and make money, to me emphasizes that it was them who sold Joseph.
So the problem is we have Ishmaelites, we have Midianites, okay? It's the brothers seem to see the Yishmaelim. The Midianim seem to be maybe the people who pulled Yosef out of the pit. Later, it seems like give me just one second to read the pasuk straight to you because I don't want to mess things up. Later, we see Yosef hurad Mitzrayma. Yosef is brought down to Egypt. Vayiknehu Potiphar's three paro sarat habachim ish mitzrim yad yishmaelim asher horiduhu shama. Okay, the Yishmaelim are the ones who bring Yosef down, but there is no mention of the Midianim. So yes, it is possible that the Midianim pulled Yosef out of the pit, but the end game is that he was sold to the Yishmaelim just like his brothers planned. So it may be that the brothers were also surprised not to find Yosef in the pit. That's a fair read. But no matter what, Reuben is the most surprised. Reuben is the most surprised because he is not participating in his brother's lunch. He's not participating in the family fully. But what we see is Reuben still wants to be involved. Because if you look at the next page, we're on page 3 right now, the brothers have now gone down to Egypt. There's a famine in the land. The brothers have gone down to get food. And Yosef is the man in charge of giving out the food in Egypt. They don't know that it's him. Yosef says to them, "You guys are spies. I'm going to put one of your brothers in jail. You're going to have to come back down with your youngest brother, Binyamin." Why Yosef has this whole plan is again, another shear. He seems to be torturing his brothers a little bit. But the brothers realize that something is happening as a punishment. The brothers realize that something is a punishment. And they say, "Vayomru isha achiv, aba ashim im anachnu al achinu, asher ra'inu tzara nafsho, b'hitzchana noe leinu v'lo shamanu, al kein ba'e leinu hatzara hazot." The brothers say to each other, "We are being punished because our brother Yosef begged us not to hurt him, and we didn't listen." Vayam ruveno tam lemor, halo amarti aleichem lemor al tachtu, b'yalev v'lo shamatem v'gam damo hinei nidrash. Reuben gets involved, and Reuben says, "Basically, I told you so." Reuben says, "Didn't I tell you guys not to do this? Didn't I tell you that we needed to not hurt this poor kid? His blood is being required of us. We are being punished because of what we did to our brother." Now, positive or negative reaction to what Reuben is doing here?
Well, it's not fair to just
so. Okay. On the one hand, he's the only person whose individual voice we hear. He is a voice within his brothers. He is someone who is talking as an individual. But the speaking he's doing is not very impressive. The speaking he's doing is trying to retroactively give himself credit for what he did. He's actually separating himself out from this unit and trying to say, "I didn't want to." Okay?
But I'm innocent. You guys are guilty.
I'm innocent. Right? They're all in trouble. They're all going to have to go back up to their father and say, we need to bring down Binyamin. They know that their father's going to say no. And Reuven says, yeah, it's your fault. It's your guys' fault that we're going to have to take away the second son of Rachel. It's your fault. And now Reuven tries one more time. Reuven wants to see himself as special and as unique and as somebody with influence. And we understand why. He is the oldest and he feels like he was doing the right thing. He knows that what the brothers did was wrong and he feels like maybe he can fix it. So what happens? The brothers go back up to their father and they say, look, we have to go back down to Egypt and we have to bring Binyamin. And Yaakov says, no, are you kidding me? Vayomer alayim Yaakov avim, oti shikaltam, Yosef enenu, v'shimon enenu, that Binyamin tikachu, alai hayukulana. Yosef is gone, Shimon is in jail in Egypt. You want to take Binyamin now? You're taking away all of my children? I am not going to let this happen. And Reuben says to his father, no, please, I will make you a promise. Vayomer Reuben el aviv lemor, et shnei banai tamit, im lo avi enu elacha. T'nau to al yadi, v'ani ashiv enu elacha. Reuben says, I will take care of Binyamin to such an extent that if I do not bring Binyamin back alive to you, you can kill my two sons. You can kill my two sons. This is Reuben doing his best to try to show his father how seriously he's going to take this responsibility. Positive or negative reactions to this?
The way of thinking in those days.
Okay, there's a little bit of a mix. On the one hand, promising to kill sons, negative, awful, bad idea.
Well,
on the other hand, he's not.
What grandfather would have accepted that?
Okay, so there's two problems. Number one, why would you offer? That's true. Number two, maybe it's not really a good promise. If I lose one son, you could kill two grandsons. Right? That doesn't seem like a great trade-off. On the other hand, Reuven is doing his utmost to take responsibility in the only way that he knows. Reuven thinks that this is actually going to work. Reuven really is trying here. But it doesn't work. Yaakov says, I'm sorry, that's not going to happen. This is the last we hear of Reuven. This is the last time that Reuven acts as an autonomous character. He tried. It didn't work. He tried, and the mantle is going to be taken up by his brother Yehuda. But in order to understand how it gets to be that Yehuda takes responsibility, actually, you know what? No, we'll look at it first. Skip to the next page. Skip to the next page to the source in the middle of the page. Reuven begs his father to let Binyamin come down to Egypt, and Yaakov says no. They run out of food. The famine gets really, really bad. And they have to do something. They have to go get more food, but they cannot go down without Binyamin. So what do they do? Someone new steps up. Yehuda steps up. Just look at Pasuk Tet, verse number 9. Yehuda says to Yaakov, Anochi e'ervenu miyadi tivakshenu. Im lo hevioti ve'lecha v'ksavti v'fanecha v'chatati lecha kol hayamim. He doesn't promise Yaakov anything. He doesn't say, if I don't bring Binyamin back. He says, I promise. He says, take me at my word. Me, I am going to be collateral for my brother. I am going to put everything of me on the line. It has nothing to do with you could kill me, you could kill my sons. It is just a straightforward promise of please, please believe me. And it works. It does work. And Yaakov agrees to send Binyamin down. But where did Yehuda get the strength to do this from? For that, we need to look at a story that, again, I wish I could give an entire shiur on. We're going to turn back to page 3. To the story of Yehuda and Tamar. Chapter 38 of Bereishit is an entirely self-contained story. Yosef has been sold down to Egypt. We will hear in chapter 39 of what happens to Yosef in Egypt. But in the middle, we have an entirely self-contained story that begins Vayehi ba'eid hahi, Vayered Yehuda me'eid achav. And it came to pass at that time that Judah went down from his brothers. Now, it is absolutely clear that this story is meant to be a part of the Yosef story. There, if I gave an entire share on Yehuda and Tamar, we would spend a lot of time looking at all of the linguistic parallels between the story of Yehuda and Tamar and the story of the selling of Yosef, because they're absolutely mind-blowing. But you'll just have to take me at my word. I know I've been asking you to do that a lot today. I do apologize. I wish we could tell, spend so much more time learning together. But what we have to do is figure out what happens to Yehuda during this story. Because Yehuda has just sold his brother to Egypt. Whether he was actually the one who sold or whether it was just his idea, Yehuda has had this leadership moment that was really negative. He had control of his brothers, but he did something awful with it. And we see he went down. The commentators read this as saying that he lost respect a little bit. He maybe had a great idea that everyone agreed with, but he couldn't bear to stay within this family. It wasn't a good place for him. They didn't really have respect for him. He goes off and lives by himself. He stops being a part of this family unit for a while, and tragedy strikes. Well, first, it's great. He gets married, and he has 3 sons. Okay? It's beautiful. His first son marries a woman named Tamar. His first son dies. So now it's the responsibility of the second son to marry Tamar, to continue the family name. So, second son marries Tamar, second son dies. Now there's a third son, there's Shelah. And Yehuda has a responsibility to give Shelah as a husband to Tamar, because Tamar's job as a widow in those days was basically to sit around waiting for her father-in-law to take care of her. So Yehuda had a responsibility to this woman, and he tells Tamar, actually, go back to your parents' house. Now, why does he say this? The Torah tells us. The Torah tells us in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Vayomer Yehuda Tamar kalato, shvi almana beit avich, adi dal Shelah b'ni. So he tells Tamar, Shelah, my third son, is not yet old enough for you to marry, so just wait a little while, but you can get married soon. But the Torah tells us that's not what he's thinking. Ki amar pen yamut gam hu ka'achav. Really, Yehuda is worried that Tamar is a cursed woman, and that if she marries Shelah, Shelah will die too. He wants to protect her. He wants to protect his son Shelah. But Tamar now has an awful life, because a widow has no prospects. She's being sent back to her parents, who sort of expected that a different family would take care of her. It's really an awful situation. And not only that, but Tamar understands that she has a responsibility to be a part of this family. She knows she married into the family of Yehuda. She is supposed to become a part of that family by continuing the line. She is supposed to have a baby with someone from this family. Shelah doesn't seem to be available. Tamar takes matters into her own hands. She dresses up like a prostitute and seduces Yehuda, because she thinks that this is really what she's responsible to do. She seduces Yehuda, and after they sleep together, she says to Yehuda, well, I know you're promising to pay me, but you have to give me something. You have to give me a deposit. You have to give me something to make sure that you will come back and pay. So he gives her 3 very important things. He gives her his signet, cords, and staff. Basically, he gives her his driver's license, his credit card, and his, I don't know,
passport.
And his passport, and his and his car keys. He gives her all of his identifying factors. And he sends his friend to try and go pay her so that he can get all these things back. She's not there. 3 months later, someone tells Yehuda, you know, your unmarried daughter-in-law, she's pregnant. Yehuda, who's considered to be an important man, probably a chief of the area, he says, well, she needs to be killed. She slept with someone. She was unmarried. She was supposed to be waiting for my son. Hosti, you have a tisareif.
She's more than unmarried.
Right. She's really an adulteress, because she's almost married to someone else. She's supposed to be waiting for this third son.
But she's not married.
She's not an adulteress.
No,
so
she is.
The problem is whether we're not.
So the problem is
that, number one, we don't know how old these characters are, and number two,
at this point, this son that hasn't been given to her.
Right. So there's one perspective that Tamar went out and did this because she saw that Shelah was getting old and Yehuda was not doing this. The problem with deciding if she's actually an adulteress or not is that we don't really know whose system we're working on. Are we working on a halachic system that comes later? Are we working on the Canaanite chieftain system where they were doing this sort of levirate marriage. We're not really sure according to whose laws. I can tell you that in halacha, in modern day, if you do have a situation where someone needs to do yibum, there is a relationship that automatically exists between the widow and the brother-in-law, who once her husband dies, there already exists some sort of relationship between the brother-in-law and the woman, to the extent that if they don't want to actually get married, they need to do chalitza. They need to do some sort of pseudo-divorce process, actually, because even though they never got married, there is a connection between them. And therefore, if in a Talmudic case, that woman did go and sleep with someone else, she would be considered a pseudo-adulteress. But that's not really the question here. The question here is, what happens when Yehuda says this woman needs to be killed? What happens when Yehuda says this woman needs to be killed, and we know that he is the one who got her pregnant? It's pretty suspenseful. It's pretty incredible, because what Tamar does, Tamar could say, no, it's yours. Tamar could get up and say, no, it's my father-in-law who got me pregnant, and I was trying to fulfill this responsibility I had to be a part of this family. But she doesn't do that. Tamar shows remarkable restraint, and instead gives Yehuda the opportunity to make things right. She goes out and she says, the person whose child I'm carrying, these belong to him. Now, maybe I was wrong when I said it's his driver's license and his passport, because they don't have his name on them. They're identifying factors, but only to someone who knows Yehuda well. Yehuda does have plausible deniability. Yehuda could say, that looks a lot like my staff, but it's not actually my staff. That looks a lot like my signet ring, but there's someone else who has a similar one. I can't think of a great example. Let's say it's, you know, a fingerprint that got slightly messed up. So it's very likely his, but he doesn't need to admit to it. But what does he do? Yehuda does a remarkable thing. Yehuda said Kami Meni. She is right. And she's not just right, she's more righteous than I am. Now, what does this mean, more righteous than I am? Yehuda implies he thought he was doing something righteous. What did Yehuda think he was doing right?
Keeping
it in the family.
Saving his son.
Yehuda learns a lesson. Yehuda learns a lesson about priorities. Yehuda thought that the most important thing was his son. He didn't realize the most important thing is his larger family unit, is a responsibility that he also has to his daughter-in-law, the responsibility that he has to propagating his family in the appropriate way. And I would claim that what's happening here is Yehuda is learning about the responsibility that he has to people who he doesn't necessarily like, to people who he doesn't necessarily feel a kinship towards. And we could assume someone Yehuda doesn't really feel kinship towards might be his brother Binyamin, right? Who's his brother Binyamin? Binyamin is the youngest son, is at least 12 years younger than Yehuda. Is at least 7 years younger than Yehuda. He's definitely the youngest by far. And he's the brother of the brother who they sold. He's probably Yaakov's favorite at this point. We know Yehuda doesn't have a great relationship to the people his father loves the most. But Yehuda learns from this that doesn't matter. Yehuda learns from this that the larger family unit is much more important. And what would... Yes?
It's troubling me why, in the midst of the business with the drama with Yosef, all of a sudden there is a sideline story about Reuven. I mean, maybe there could be for each son, a personal story in what he did. Why bringing the whole thing in the middle of the
I think that's the perfect question to ask, and I think what I want to say is that we're going to be shocked by the way the story ends. Because instead of looking at it inside, I'll say, Yehuda becomes the hero of the family. When Yosef tries to keep Binyamin in Egypt with him, Yehuda steps up and says, that's not okay. I have a responsibility to my father. I'm not going to let this happen. And we should be shocked by this. Yehuda just sold his brother Yosef. What's Yehuda doing protecting this brother Binyamin? Yehuda probably doesn't even like Binyamin. And what happens here, the reason we need the story of Yehuda and Tamar is to explain to us what happened to Yehuda, to explain to us how this brother, who is a leader in this incredibly negative sense, who convinced his brother to sell their other brother down to Egypt, how did it how did it happen that he became the positive leader? How did it happen that if you look at source, well, on page 5, the source in the middle, when Yaakov blesses his sons, Yaakov says, Yehuda, you are going to be the leader of your brothers. Yes, we know Yehuda is the leader of the brothers, but in this incredibly negative sense. Where did he learn this family responsibility? He learned it from his daughter-in-law Tamar. And the Torah could not have skipped that story. It's not that, oh, we just want to know interesting things that happened. We need to figure out how did Yehuda get to this place, and that's because Tamar taught it to him.
A woman taught it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This is a message, not only a woman. This is a woman who went and dressed up as a prostitute, and the Torah vindicates it to such an amazing extent. The Torah says this was absolutely the right thing to do. Not only was it a fine thing to do, but you are teaching them, you are what allows Yehuda to become the leader of his family, and the twins that Tamar has, Peretz and Zerach, that is where King David comes from. King David comes from these children that Tamar bore when she pretended to be a prostitute to get Yehuda to impregnate her. What happens is there's a little bit of a message about what kind of quality a king needs, that sometimes it's a little bit, not bending the rules, but sometimes kingship comes from interesting places. We know King David also had a great-grandmother Ruth who did not even start out being a Jew. The qualities that it takes to be a leader are not always the ones that we would necessarily expect. But we're just going to end off. We have 3 minutes. I don't want to keep you longer. First, look at the last source on page 5. Which is just to show that I didn't make this up. In Divrei Hayamim, nobody really reads Divrei Hayamim because it's mostly a list of names, but sometimes you find a gem. Sometimes you find a pasuk that tells you you are doing the right thing. Because the pasuk tells us, Ubnei Reuven b'chor Yisrael, ki hu ha-b'chor. Ubechal lo yitzvei aviv, nitna b'chorato l'bnei Yosef ben Yisrael, v'lo lehityaches la-b'chora, ki Yehuda gavar b'achav, l'nagid mimenu v'ha-b'chora l'Yosef. Reuven was the oldest, but he messed up. So, part of his being oldest went to Yosef, but the leadership went to Yehuda. Everything that we've been studying basically is vindicated by this pasuk. This pasuk tells us, yes, you're right to think that Reuven should have been the oldest, but Reuven was on a path that was not right. So, the leadership got split in two, and that's what's on the last page, which we're not going to look at inside, which is that there are two things that an oldest gets. Number one, he gets to be the leader of the family. He gets to have a sort of kingly responsibility, and he gets to help make decisions for them, but also he gets a double inheritance. And it turns out, this I want to leave you with to think about over the course of the next few weeks as you read the stories of Yosef. Yosef ends up with the double portion. Yosef's sons, Ephraim and Menashe, are told by Yaakov that they're considered like all of the regular sons of Yaakov. Yosef's inheritance in the land of Israel is doubled. But he does not become the king. Yehuda is the one who's given this right of kingship. So there's basically what we see is that Yehuda took over the personal responsibilities of Reuven. Reuven lost the right for his personality to be the leader. And Yehuda got that because of what he learned from the story of Tamar and because of the way that he was able to convince his father and brothers to do things that are right. But Yosef, and I want you to think about this, I'm not going to tell you any particular answer. Yosef in his time in Egypt, what he accomplished was saving his family's Jewish identity enough for them to count as a double portion in the land of Israel. I want to give you a Hanukkah present. Just to prove that if you don't believe what I said about Reuven and Yehuda, it's not just based on their characters, it's also hidden in the literary style of the text itself. I'm going to tell you the story of Yosef and his brothers one more time. I'm going to tell you the story. If anyone has a pen, you're welcome to write this down because it's going to be interesting. What happens first is Yaakov sends his son to Egypt. I'm going to call that part A. Part B, we'll call the brothers accused of spying, and Reuven speaks out. Reuven talks to his brothers and tells them what they did wrong. Part C, Yosef cries because of what he hears his brothers talking about. We didn't see that part, but when the brothers talk about, oh, we didn't help our brother, Yosef cries. Part D, money is hidden in the brothers' sacks, and they find it. And part E, When they get back home, Reuven tries to convince Yaakov to send Binyamin down to Egypt. And then the famine is pretty bad. What happens next? Yehuda convinces Yaakov to send Binyamin down. Then they try to return the money that was hidden in their sacks. Yosef cries when he sees Binyamin. The brothers are accused of stealing the cup, and Yehuda speaks out. And the whole family then goes down to Egypt. Now, it's not fair because I don't have a whiteboard here, but what we have is called a chiastic structure or a menorah structure. Okay? What happens here is that everything that's the way the story started of the Yaakov sending his sons down to Egypt is paralleled by the end of the story, when the whole family goes down to Egypt. When the brothers are accused of spying and Reuven speaks out, at the end the brothers are accused of stealing a cup, and it's Yehuda who speaks out. When Yosef cries because of what his brothers say, it's parallel to at the end when Yosef cries when he sees his brother Binyamin. Now, the money is hidden and the brothers discover it, and at the end the whole story happens because they try to give the money back. Then, at the end of the first half of the story, Reuven tries to convince Yaakov to send Binyamin down. And in the second half of the story, when the entire thing flips, it's Yehuda who tries to convince Yaakov to send Binyamin down, and there he succeeds. The whole beginning of the story is Reuven trying to grasp this leadership role, but we finally see him fail when Yaakov refuses to send Binyamin down with him. The whole story happens again. The whole story happens again, and here every role that Reuven took the first time, we see it taken by Yehuda. It's not just what we see in, you know, the progression of the personality of Yehuda that we know that he learned, but we see the text is actually trying to show us that they literally flip responsibilities. And by the end of the story, there's no question that Yehuda is really going to be the one to be the tribe of kingship. And generally we call this a chiastic structure. Hopefully in two classes we'll spend some time talking about how chiastic structures work and what they teach us. But just for now, a little Hanukkah gift. If you draw it right, it looks like a menorah. So that's kind of a fun little thing
to take with us.
Where did I get this from? I personally heard this from Rav Yonatan Grossman, who's a teacher at Yeshivat Haaretzion in Israel. He's written, I think he wrote a whole book about the story of Yosef, and a lot of what he does is find parallels in the stories to each other to figure out how it's really very much a cycle. The brothers are going down, the brothers are coming up. The story, the more times you read it, the more times you realize things keep repeating, and stories are repeating, and people are going down and up, and different people are taking each other's roles. And so the one I have a list of like five chiastic structures in the story of Yosef, but the one I want to leave you with is this one that shows us how even though Reuven may have been the oldest brother, and maybe Yosef was the one who his father thought was going to be the leader, it's really the person who developed over the course of the story. It's really the person whose personality eventually shone through that got to be the leader of the Jewish people. So thank you so much for coming. I hope to see you next month. And have a happy Hanukkah.
Do you want these back?
No, feel free to keep them.
And let's...
Are you going to post these online?
Yes. Okay,